It started simply enough, a midweek presser at the Capitol. It was routine. I mean, there's no breaking news in a congressional investigation. There was no significant piece of new legislation to announce. This day, like so many others, was just another day when the filibuster had obstructed passage of a bill proposed and supported by nearly every representative of the majority party. On this day, it was the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that lay in ruins at the feet of Senate Republicans.
Oh, I mean, it's the kind of democracy dismantling move whose commonality makes it barely newsworthy these days.
Then, Latino Rebels Capitol Hill reporter Pablo Manriquez stepped to the mic and posed a question to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
What's your message for voters of color who are concerned that without the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act, they're not going to be able to vote in the midterm?
Well, the concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans.
Yeah, let's hear that one again.
African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans.
Now what's happened next has been epic. Americans took to social media using the hashtag MitchPlease to declare their outrage about Senator McConnell's discursive racial faux pas, which seemed to nullify black citizenship by eliminating the racial modifier for white Americans. When McConnell compared African Americans to Americans, I mean, it's not like he was performing a complex expression of Du Boisian double consciousness. And to many, it felt more like a Freudian revelation that the most powerful Republican lawmaker in the country considers black Americans to be distinct from real Americans. Now, the heavily populated Mitch Please hashtag isn't quite as pervasive as that time that Kim Kardashian West broke the internet with her paper magazine spread in 2014. But just like Kardashian, Senator McConnell did show his backside. And y'all are not having it. Here's what you told us.
He's probably just embodied more of the Trump sense of the sense of stage presence, where you just say the part that you were thinking out loud and then later on just go back and say, oh, that's not what I meant. But that's exactly what he meant. It's a racist comment. He's a racist man.
I think this is just another example of how the U.S. sees anyone that is not white. I think he's representative of what is happening everywhere. It doesn't matter how hard you try to get your citizenship here or how you have been living here for several generations. If you're not white, then you're not American.
Nothing surprising about what Mitch said. His mouth said what his heart believes. He just didn't expect it to come out.
We thought you were still locked in the 19th century, but with your recent comment, now it's clear.
Since when are African Americans not Americans? The guy needs to put his white hood back on and go to a rally. I'm sorry. This is too much. The country is too polarized.
Phew. Okay, takeaway. Just go ahead and take a breath. Now, let me be honest. I'm a little less worked up than many. Maybe it's because I've spent a decade being ritually and digitally dragged by ideological opponents operating in bad faith. Maybe it's because Senator McConnell was born in 1942 in Sheffield, Alabama, a town essentially founded by Andrew Jackson. So I'm pleased that a 79-year-old white man from Sheffield, that McConnell, well, he can say African-American without a sneer or a stumble. What does interest me deeply? What makes me lean in with curiosity, compassion, and concern is the response. I'm utterly captivated by the African-American office holders, veterans, teachers, parents, community leaders, media professionals, those anonymous and famous, young and elderly from every region of the country, posting photos, telling their intergenerational stories of citizenship, presence, participation, sacrifice. To me, it feels like watching an entire community producing our long-form birth certificates in mass. It's like Denzel Washington in The Great Debaters. Mitch Please ends up resounding like a unified recitation of Langston Hughes.
I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh. And I eat well, and I grow strong. Tomorrow I will sit at the table when company comes, Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am American.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and we begin today's takeaway with the question, who, too, is American? I'm joined by Pablo Manriquez, Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. It's great to have you here, Pablo.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It's always an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. And also with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who is the Ford Foundation Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School and co-host of the podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are. Welcome back, Khalil.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Pablo, I'm going to come to you. So how is it feeling to help break the internet?
Oh my gosh, it's such a testament to the power of journalism, because I think for like 99.9% of the people who have heard the Mitch McConnell clip, my voice asking the question is just sort of like a disembodied voice. So there's something very humbling to that. Like, my mother recognized my voice when she saw it on Colbert, which was awesome. But overall, it's very humbling to know that, like, you know, a question from a disembodied voice is me and nobody knows it. But everybody knows the response and everybody's reacting to the response one way or another. I think that your assessment of the way it's blown up on the internet is very apt. I absolutely love the poem by Langston Hughes. And I think that that is a question that needed to be asked more and more, not just of Mitch McConnell, but of other lawmakers. For example, the day before I asked Mitch McConnell the question, I asked Joe Manchin the question, who is another person obstructing the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act from within the Democratic Party. I asked him, you know, what do you say to voters of color who are afraid they're not going to be able to vote in the midterm if the John L. Lewis voting rights doesn't pass? And he said, well, the government will protect them. The government will make sure that they are able to vote. When I would ask about voters of color, pretty much every lawmaker who I asked, and these were senators, every senator who I asked said, well, African-Americans are X, you know, X, Y, and Z, they're safe, right? Mm-hmm. So it was like voters of color all automatically become, in the minds of these senators, African-Americans. Like, they have sort of like a knee-jerk reaction to the question. And I think that that's notable.
I want to play one quick thing, because McConnell spoke on Friday. And he said he was clarifying what he said. Let's take a listen.
I want to take an opportunity out there here to address the outrageous mischaracterization of my history and record on voting rights and race relations as a result of inadvertently leaving out the word almost in my comments the other day.
Pablo, where does the almost go?
That's a really good question, because as I read it, he meant almost Americans. So African Americans are voting in just as high a percentage as almost Americans, because after he gave that comment, and he tripled down on that comment after he initially said it, because the reporters, hat tipped to the reporters in Kentucky and in Louisville, Kentucky, who are asking him that question at the Kentuckian Transportation Expo, they said, you know, are you sure you meant to say almost? He's like, the word that was omitted was almost. And then he exited the stage and the camera pans to him. And I assume somebody who is an advisor to McConnell was, you know, a woman kind of walked up to him and showed him her cell phone. And on his cell phone, you could sort of audibly hear her saying, you said almost instead of all, right? And he turned around and he says, the word that was omitted was all. So I assume what he's saying is African-Americans are voting in just as high a percentage as all Americans is what he meant to say. But in my opinion, it just made it worse. McConnell is not somebody who often misspeaks, too, which I think is like really worth saying. He speaks slowly. He speaks deliberately. And most of the time when you catch him in the hallway, he doesn't even acknowledge your presence. He will walk right through your question.
Now, Khalil, what's going on with McConnell is one thing. What's going on with the response is a bit of something else. And I am fascinated by the extent to which, you know, in a nation right now that is deeply polarized, where a lot of hurtful, painful, kind of jaw-dropping things are said on a regular basis, this one really caught fire. I'm wondering what it tells you about that sense of perhaps disconnectedness, or maybe it actually is a sense of connectedness with the nation. Why did voters of color, why do Black and Latino voters right now feel such a need to respond to this?
Well, I think when you have perhaps the most powerful politician in Washington, and I'm not speaking of Joe Biden, but in fact, Mitch McConnell, and the juxtaposition, this sort of racialized or racist juxtaposition, hits home essentially right at the moment of Dr. King's annual holiday. And so you've got the convergence of this powerful opponent of racial progress in this country. You've got the annual rituals of celebration of Dr. King, who's been completely whitewashed and sanitized, and whose legacy has been completely inverted 180 degrees by Mitch McConnell's himself and his party. And then finally, you have the most recent news of yet the failed efforts to protect voting rights in this country. And so I think people just emotionally responded as well they should have.
Khalil, I'm wondering what it also suggests, again, whether for McConnell or in this broader response, about the sort of unspoken racialization of the American identity at all points. This idea of the replacement theory, which we know is a critical part of how many in the January 6th riots were feeling, you know, you shall not replace us. And then this kind of battle right now about teaching a racialized history in K through 12 and even college classrooms. I'm wondering about, like, can we get to a point where American is not only Jefferson, but Jefferson's children who were born by an enslaved woman?
Yes, potentially, but we will only get there if people have the right to vote and can actually build the country in that image, meaning that how we socialize children in our schools depends on a curriculum that is honest and truthful and representative of all the threads of the United States history, including indigenous people from the very beginning. It depends on our ability to create an infrastructure that supports life for everyone in ways that are not extractive as they were built from the very beginning. I mean, you know, the great irony of this moment is, you know, it reveals yet again for anyone who maybe just turned 18 last weekend is like, oh, now I'm politically conscious, what our country has been. If we want a different country, unfortunately, the pathway to get there is going to pass through what happens at our polls. And so the Republican Party knows exactly what it's doing. It was once the Democratic Party, you know, many years ago. But for a long time, at least a third to half of this country has been opposed to a real functioning democracy and the potential for what we need to redress since 2013, when John Roberts said something very similar to what Mitch McConnell said, is we don't need the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act because the Southern states don't look as Southern and racist as they used to. And so Black voters are voting. So why do we need this anyway? I mean, the echoes are just astounding and recurring.
Pablo, I want to come back to you on this sticking point around non-white voters or non-white Americans equals African Americans. And maybe we could talk a little bit here about the limits of like a citizenship identity as the requirement for Americanness. What are or a particular like Black-white trajectory in our understanding about what America is composed of? Can you talk to me a little bit about that other aspect of the question that you asked about voters of color, and he went directly to Black folk?
Yeah, I think that one of the things you'll find about Republicans generally in the Senate and in the House is that I think about the term African-American as something that's sort of antiquated. I'm not Black, but I've come to most of my friends who have been involved in this discussion have preferred the term Black. I used voters of color because it's hard to name off every group that would be disenfranchised if the John L. Lewis a Voting Rights Act didn't pass, and it didn't pass, right? And the concerns I find that people are telling me about whether or not they're going to be able to vote in the midterm are super legit, in some states more than others. So for Republicans to say again and again, often quoting Dr. King, that Black people don't know what they're talking about, right, when it comes to their vote, was highly offensive to me. But it's also telling of a Congress. And when I say Congress, I don't just mean the elected officials. I mean the entire building, the entire Capitol complex that is entirely too white. You know, like the overwhelming majority of people of color who you will see in the Capitol complex on a daily basis, right, are police, they're service workers. On occasion, you'll find some staffers, but that is sort of changing. For example, this year, they had Representative Zoe Lofgren, who's sort of Nancy Pelosi's right-hand woman in the House of Representatives, approved the passage approved the formation of a Congressional Progressive Staff Association. And this was kind of a big deal. Over 500 people signed up right away. Now you have on Instagram, for example, you have accounts like Dear White Staffers, which is one of the best tipster accounts anywhere on Instagram. If you're trying to work on Capitol Hill, if you're trying to understand just how toxically white the environment can be for staffers who aren't white in the Capitol. So Dear White Staffers and other account, Tired Press Secretary, these are some of the other accounts that have popped up that were kind of unthinkable just a few years ago. So I think that one of the things that the comment kind of points out is just how insular that bubble is. And within that insular bubble, just how white the environment is when you're working as a representative or as a staffer in the Capitol complex, where these votes, where these decisions are made about that that will help or hurt the ability of people throughout the nation to vote and exercise their rights as Americans.
That's a fascinating perspective, and one that obviously most of us don't have, not being insiders within that building or within that the culture of what's happening in that space. There was something else about what he said, and Khalil, I want to come to you on this because I do think that back end part of it keeps us from talking about the front end part, where he makes an assessment, the center makes an assessment about voting, and he's sort of right and wrong, right? Like my inner political science has jumped up screaming and saying, no, I want to address the empirical claim here, because in fact, in 2008 and then in 2012, African-American voting actually exceeded turnout, and particularly for Black women, exceeded turnout for that of white folks. But then in 2016 and 2020, you saw sort of white American voting resurging during these two opportunities to vote for President Trump. And in 2020, everybody turned out at some of the highest rates that we have seen in American history. So it occurs to me that voter suppression efforts might also suppress some white voters. Like, this is generally bad for democracy.
Yeah, but democracy has been bad for minority interests in this country for a long time. So that is all too
familiar. Are you saying we feel okay about sometimes just making a mess of the whole democratic system, Khalil?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think that's what I'm saying. I mean, listen, we have to point out the absurdity of what's going on here. So the justification for blocking the protection of votes in federal elections, mind you, is that everyone's voting. But in fact, at the state level, that everyone voting generated at least 20 bills passed in, at least 30 bills passed in something like 20 states. And so he's not even working with reality. If everything was great and we should keep things the same, things aren't the same because they've actually changed at the state level. So part of this is just keeping up with the lies that come from a party that is not interested in a functioning, healthy democracy, as January 6th attests to, and their unwillingness to come to terms with or accept a fully functioning investigative process.
Pablo, I have to ask you this question. Do you have a list of other questions that you would like to see your colleagues on the Hill or my colleagues and me asking of elected leaders across the coming year? Because, boy, that was a good question.
Well, I think that, and this is something that I've talked about with some of the other reporters on Capitol Hill and at the White House, I think that one of the things that we have to start doing is just leading with the phrase, what's your message for voters of color about? Right. And then the topic that you're covering, because I think that too often we don't center the people who are most impacted by legislation, in this case, like the John L. Lewis Voting Rights Act. Right. So what is Joe Biden's message of color
gets hard.
I know. No, but the question that I have this week for Joe Biden at the White House, because Congress is in recess, is, what is his message for immigrants about the unilateral authority that he is willing to exercise as president of the United States to find some forms of immigrant relief that were promised on the campaign trail? There were 167 questions asked last week at Joe Biden's like 2-hour press conference in the East Room of the White House, and none of the questions were about immigration, not a single one. And the sad thing is that when immigration does come up as a topic, and this is a topic that Latino Rebels covers every single day, right? We are day in and day out on the immigration beat. The sad thing is that when you actually do hear the word immigration or immigrants at a White House press conference, it's always in some attempt to have like a gotcha moment about the border, right? Like, how bad do you think you're doing at the border, sir? But that's not what the topic was during the campaign trail when he promised immigrants communities that if he won, he was going to help them out. So far, immigrant communities have not been helped out in the way that he promised. So we've done the diligence on the Hill in the last year. We have asked we've asked pretty much every senator in the Democratic caucus now in the Senate about what they're going to do for immigration. And so far, they've just given us the runaround, right? At this point, we've probably gotten 75% of the entire United States Senate on the record about immigration, and every superstar you can imagine in the House of Representatives. And again, they give us all these answers like, yeah, we support this, we support that, but they don't actually do anything. So I think that one of the things that the White House staff, because we're not members of the White House Press Association, so we're not actually allowed, or sorry, the White House Court, we're, sorry, we are not members. Latino Rebels is not members of the White House Correspondents Association. So we are not allowed to go sit in the White House briefing rooms in a chair and ask questions. We're only allowed to take the aisle. But because they have COVID restrictions in place now, they're saying that we can't go. But it's like, hold on a second. You say we can't be a member of your organization and we can't stand in the aisle, which is allocated to people like us who aren't members of your organization. That's not going to fly. So I think that you're going to have a little bit of conflict between us and the White House Correspondents Association this week if they don't find a way to include us in these press conferences, because our question is important and we're going to ask it.
The gauntlet has been laid down, folks, by Pablo Manriquez, Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. Time to ask the question repeatedly, what about immigration reform, Mr. President, given that you do have some unilateral authority as President of the United States? With us also was Khalil Gibran Muhammad, Ford Foundation Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and co-host of the podcast Some of My Best Friends Are. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank
for
you,
me.
Melissa.
They don't believe that anyone who is not a white Republican is a real American. And they believe that all of these registered, valid votes were how the election was stolen, because they don't believe that people who are not white Americans should be able to register and vote. And they believe that the country is being stolen by people who don't look like them.
These are the same Republican lines that they've been saying for years. They used to say back in 1964, black people don't have problems voting. They just have to count all these jelly beans. They just have to tell me how many bubbles are in this bar of soap, or read this piece of the Constitution.
Truthfully, it's an embarrassment to be from the same state as Mitch McConnell. It's truly, truly awful. And it's just another sad mark against Kentucky, I suppose. I don't know. It makes me really sad. I can't believe he's still in office. We need to get him out.
Want to be part of our show? Call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. And give us your thoughts on any of our stories. And you can even send us a voice recording or memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.